Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to the March edition of the Chemistry World Podcast with James Mitchell Crowe, Nina Notman, Phil Broadwith, and Matt Wilkinson. Coming up, how to get more oxygen out of hemoglobin and into tissues. Scientists have developed a compound that can do just that.
They used both healthy mice and mice that were genetically engineered to mimic mice that had severe heart failure. And they showed that the more the compound was delivered, the more both sets of animals could exercise, up to 70% more in some cases.
And that agent might be very effective for the treatment of heart failure. There'll be more from Matt Wilkinson on that story coming up shortly. Also, how scientists are turning up the heat in cell biology with a new form of chemical thermometer.
This is some research coming out of Japan, which is taking a fluorescent polymer gel, injecting it into cells, and measuring the fluorescence to tell the changes in temperature within the cell as it goes about its normal biological processes.
Phil Broadwith will be explaining how that temperature-sensitive polymer works in just a moment. Plus, on the subject of polymers, how scientists have made biological nets that can grab bacteria.
When those antibiotics attach themselves to bacteria, the polymer changes from, if you can imagine, a sort of branch piece of spaghetti, they appear to collapse. So this open system becomes a tighter, collapsed coil, if you like.
That's Steve Rimmer, who's developing smart polymers that can change their shape when they meet a bacterium. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
The Chemistry World Podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
Heart failure occurs when the heart can't pump enough oxygenated blood to supply the needs of the body's tissues. So far, treatments have focused largely on trying to improve the heart's function to make up for the shortfall. But now, there might be another way to combat the problem, by persuading hemoglobin to relinquish the oxygen that it carries much more readily. Tell us about this, Matt.
Right, well, researchers led by Jean-Marie Len, the Nobel Prize winner who works at the Institute Louis Pasteur in Strasbourg, has developed a cyclic pyrophosphate molecule known as myo-inositol trisphosphate, or ITPP for short, that binds to the outside of hemoglobin, which is the molecule that carries oxygen around the body and delivers it to the muscles and organs so that they can live. And it binds to the outside of the hemoglobin and subtly changes the oxygen binding pocket in the centre of hemoglobin such that it reduces ever so slightly, by about 30%, the binding affinity of the hemoglobin for the oxygen so it can be delivered to those organs.
So the hemoglobin is giving up the oxygen more readily than it would do normally?
Absolutely, yeah. It still picks up the oxygen just as well from the lungs. But the point is that when oxygen-starved tissue comes into contact, it releases that oxygen much, much more readily.
Is this just tests that have been done in the dish, or have they shown this in animals, that it really works in a living organism to make the hemoglobin behave like this?
Well, they've actually done this in mice. They used both healthy mice and mice that were genetically engineered to mimic mice that had severe heart failure. And they showed that the more the compound was delivered, the more both sets of animals could exercise, up to 70% more in some cases.
That's phenomenal. So are they saying then this could be the answer to Britain succeeding in the London 2012 Olympics, or is there actually a sensible therapeutic point to this?
Well, they do suggest that it could be used as a performance-enhancing drug, although its utility wouldn't be that great because it would be quite easy to spot using most drug testing procedures. However, the major use for this would be that they could give it to people with heart failure, and that could then help those tissues and organs around the body that were being starved of oxygen get more oxygen, and so that the damage done by a heart attack would be much, much less.
And I presume also people with heart failure could benefit too, because where there isn't the capacity in the heart in order to get the oxygen around the body in the same way, you just get more oxygen out of the blood, so the heart workload doesn't increase, but much better oxygenation of the tissue.
Absolutely, yeah. It would work in exactly the way you described, so that it would just basically allow those tissues to survive for longer while somebody could come along and get the heart working again.
Thank you, Matt. Well, let's talk a about cells still, but this time talking about turning up the heat on cells, or at least measuring that heat. Phil, tell us about this.
Yes, Chris, this is some research coming out of Japan, which is taking a fluorescent polymer gel, injecting it into cells, and measuring the fluorescence to tell the changes in temperature within the cell as it goes about its normal biological processes.
How on earth are they doing that?
This guy, Seiichi Uchiyama, in the University of Tokyo, has invented a water-sensitive fluorescent molecule, which he's built into a polymer gel, or built into a polymer matrix, and then turned that into a nanoscale gel. The polymer has a very open structure at low temperature, which allows water to get inside. That water quenches the fluorescence. But when you increase the temperature, the polymer structure collapses, which flushes out all of the water and increases the fluorescence.
So how do they see this actually being used, and what does it tell you?
There's two uses for it. Eventually, they want to be able to localise the gel on different areas of the cell to map temperature changes and relate those to biological processes. But the other interesting thing is that diseased cells, pathogenic cells, have a much higher metabolic rate than healthy cells. So if you could use the difference in fluorescence as an indicator of disease, as a diagnostic tool.
How do we know this is real, though? If you are injecting a foreign substance into a cell, which is capable of telling the temperature of that cell, but it diffuses through the cell, how do you know it's not actually affecting the behaviour of the cells or even insulating bits of the cells so they appear warmer than you might think they are or than they are normally?
I'm not too sure about the insulation effects of the gel, but they have made very sure that the gel doesn't interact chemically with any of the elements present in a cell. So they've made the polymer coating is chemically inert, and then there's a layer of ionic sulfate groups on the outside which help it to be soluble and distribute around the cell.
People have tried to measure temperature with GFP in the past, haven't they? Because GFP winks on and off the light at a different frequency according to the temperature. So why is this better than that?
GFP is a very large protein, and also being a protein has the potential to interact with various other processes that are going on with the cell. It can be fooled by changes in ionic strength and in pH. This polymer is completely inert to all of those effects. It's only affected by temperature.
Hot stuff. Thanks, Phil. And sticking with polymers, to a new way now to protect wounds from infection. Scientists have found a way to functionalise polymer chains so that they can grab bacteria and pluck them out of wounds. Stephen Rimmer.
Basically, me and my colleague Linda Swanson from Sheffield Uni have been working on both the synthesis and properties of polymers that we call smart polymers or stimulus-responsive polymers in water. If we take some of these polymers and we make a particular architecture, and that is we make a branched architecture, and then we take fragments of antibiotics and attach them to all the ends of the chains, then when those antibiotics attach themselves to bacteria, the polymer changes. And it changes from, if you can imagine, a sort of branched piece of spaghetti, they appear to collapse. So this open system becomes a tighter collapsed coil, if you like.
And this presumably sequesters the bacteria inside the polymer at the same time.
That's right. Well, what happens is, you see, when the polymers bind, they go through this transition. After the transition, the material's now a very good surface, so like an adhesive for bacteria, if you like. What happens then is the bacteria actually sort of stick to each other. So the best way to picture this is the polymer acting like a glue, and the sort of glue's a better glue than the wound is.
What's the polymer actually made of?
Right, well, it's a polymer called polyN-isopropylacrylamide, which is a very well-known material. It's, you know, been used in clinical applications before. And it has this special property in that it's water-soluble, but it has what we call a lower critical solution temperature. And that means it comes out of solution as we increase the temperature.
And are they safe in the human body?
Pretty safe. In general, most polymers, they're safe. There are very, very few examples of clinical issues with polymeric materials, and in fact most of the issues are normally with, you know, monomers basically giving toxicity. But we've, you know, we've a whole set of regulatory procedures to get through now, and I guess, you know, with our industrial partners, that's going to be probably the next stage. What we certainly have done is we've had the polymers exposed to human cells in culture, and we don't see any toxicity issues.
So why do you need to use antibiotics on the polymer to bait it? Could you not just use any molecule that will stick to the bacteria?
Yeah, we can, we can. The reason we've used antibiotics, and I have to make the point that when the antibiotics are attached to the polymers, they're no longer active as antibiotics, so they don't kill the bacteria. And we've no reason to believe that there'll be any issues with multiple acquired resistance, for example. There's a wealth of data out there on the binding of antibiotics and potential antibiotics to bacteria. So really, that's why we started. It was just a place where we knew certain molecules would bind to certain parts of different types of bacteria.
So when it comes to actually using this, how does the polymer get applied? Is it in the form of a sheet that you can then put over a damaged piece of skin? Could you use this internally within the body, within, for instance, a bone graft? Because bone infections are a major problem, particularly in military context. How would you use it?
Right, well, we can do both of those, actually. So the stuff that we've actually prepared for publication at the moment concerns a soluble version of the polymer. And so that in that case, we would just apply a solution, and you certainly could use it internally. In a biofluid of some sort. And in that case, the bacteria then goes through this transition as a solution. But the other thing we've done recently is to attach it to a hydrogel membrane. So these are materials very similar to contact lens materials and used quite extensively in wound dressings. So that material we envisage as being a type of wound dressing, if you like, which could be applied as a sheet.
And when the bacteria are sequestered by the material, what happens to them then? And how do you get the material that's got the bacteria glued inside it back out?
Yeah, OK, that's a good point. So as far as we can ascertain at the moment, the bacteria seem to stay viable. We see a small decrease in viability, so a few of them die, but the figure is about 80% of the bacteria remaining active and alive. In the terms of this membrane material, it's relatively easy. You can envisage a nurse, for instance, just applying the material like a standard wound dressing, and then when it was infected, basically she would remove it and replace it with another wound dressing. It's a little bit more difficult if you think how we would get inside the body, and if we had the polymers actually inside, then, yeah, that will be quite difficult to remove them. With the open wounds, though, and my colleague Sheila McNeil's an expert in making sort of models, if you like, in vitro models of the in vivo situation. And what she's done is she's managed to make a skin model, which she actually burns and then infects with bacteria. And what we've been doing there is to take the soluble polymer, add it to the wound, and then really the bacteria just washed out, essentially, so that the polymer detaches them from the wound tissue, and then we just, just a saline wash would be sufficient just to wash them away.
Stephen Rimmer, he's based at Sheffield University. And one other thing he told me is that he's also close to completing a system that will enable the polymers to also change colour when they pick up a bacterium, which will give doctors an instant visual warning that a wound could be infected. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. And still to come, a new way to combat high cholesterol. Scientists have made a nanoparticle that works like HDL, good cholesterol. And also how rainforests affect the composition and chemistry of the atmosphere. But first, James, scientists have taken a fresh look at how carbon nanotubes grow.
Well, that's right. They have some insights based on a computational model of how carbon nanotubes might grow. The interest behind this is that the nanotubes have all sorts of interesting properties, from sort of electronic properties to the fact they're incredibly strong. But in order to make the most of those properties and potentially fine-tune them, what scientists really want to be able to do is control the way that the nanotubes grow.
And how do you do that?
Well, in order to control how they grow, you really need to understand how they grow in the ways that they're made at the moment. So what this team have done is they've modelled how the tubes grow. They don't roll up like a sheet of paper. They sort of grow along the length. They self-assemble along the length of the nanotube. So carbon atoms get gradually added to the end of the tube. And
is that done sort of ring by ring by ring? Because if you look at these nanotubes, it's almost like layers of carbon atoms. Or is it done by adding individual atoms at a time?
It is atoms being added one at a time. And these guys argue that effectively carbon strands, sort of chains of carbons, form from the ends of these nanotubes, and they sort of wrap together. So multiple strands will be forming at the same time at the end of the nanotube, and they wrap together effectively to sort of zip this thing up.
It's like hair plaiting.
Yes, that's right. Or they analogy that they use is like almost like weaving a rug. They say that the more strands that is active on each tube, then the quicker the tube grows. That affects the chirality of the tube, because the more strands that are growing, sort of the more twisted the bonds are that are formed. And experimentally, it's known that chiral nanotubes are more numerous than the less chiral nanotubes. So they say that that's evidence backs up their theory.
How would you actually manipulate that or use that so that you could govern the number of threads that are growing, wrapping around each other at any given time, and therefore the chirality, and therefore the function of these nanotubes?
Well, that's very much a question for the future. Understanding this process is the first step. But obviously, if you could control the number of strands that form, then it sounds like that would have quite a significant impact on the way that these things grow.
And what sorts of things do people want to be able to do with these structures?
As I mentioned, these things have interesting electronic properties. They conduct in the same way that graphene does. But often when you produce carbon nanotubes, you end up with a mixture of conducting and non-conducting tubes, and it's very difficult to separate them. So if you were able to produce one or the other, then you could either have a material that had nice insulating properties or have a material that had nice conducting properties and make the most of that.
Thank you very much, James. So, Namat, turning now away from nanotubes but towards the body potentially, and cholesterol, high cholesterol, if it's of the LDL variety, is a bad thing. Scientists have now come up with a way potentially of tackling that by making high-density lipoprotein, HDL, which is the good form of cholesterol. How are they doing it?
Well, Chris, what Chad Merkin at Northwestern University has actually done is made a synthetic mimic of HDL. And that molecule is, as you well know, is the molecule that binds cholesterol and transports it to the liver so that it can be disposed.
And how have they done that? How are they making these synthetic HDLs?
Well, what they've done is they've taken a gold nanoparticle at the core, as the core of this molecule, of this structure, and then onto that they've added three different molecules. One is apolipoprotein A1. And then they've taken two different phospholipids. One is a disulfide, which binds very strongly to the gold nanoparticle, and the other is phosphatidylcholine, which is found in HDL itself. So this structure itself, it's not really a drug. What it is a mimic of the actual structure of the high-density lipoprotein.
And the idea of this would be that you could effectively artificially elevate someone's HDL, which we know translates into protection from heart attacks.
Exactly, yes. I mean, there's been lots and lots of interest in trying to make HDL-raising compounds by the pharmaceutical industry. LDL-lowering drugs are well known. Indeed, the world's biggest-selling drug, Lipitor, is an LDL-lowering drug. It's one of the statin families of drugs. But there's been a few attempts to make HDL-raising drugs, and unfortunately, most of those have failed so far. I believe there's one or two still going through clinical trials, but everything's gone quiet on that front at the moment.
So this could potentially be very promising, but would you use it on its own, or are the pharma industry suggesting that you could combine this with an LDL-lowering drug so that you get the best of both worlds, HDL up, LDL down?
Well, Pfizer were looking at both lowering LDL cholesterol and increasing HDL cholesterol. But unfortunately, when their drug torsatrapib failed a phase 3 clinical trial, that seemed to put the kibosh on that whole idea. But maybe with actually using a synthetic mimic of HDL, the future might look a little bit brighter.
Now, the research that's been done on these gold nanoparticles behaving as HDL, Is that actually into animals yet, or are they still proving this in the dish?
I mean, so far they've actually only proved this in the dish, and what they've done is they've added it to a cell culture and shown that it does bind cholesterol. One of the things that they do say is that they actually, rather than having created a drug, they've created a drug lead that might help lead to actual therapeutics. But it's a, I think the whole thing is that they've developed a new concept that does bind cholesterol very strongly. One of the things that they will have to develop if they're putting it into the body is making sure that it does not, you know, it does pick up the cholesterol, but then it also can be easily transported to the liver and that the cholesterol can be got rid of.
Exciting news, especially at a time when the drug pipeline is otherwise looking very empty. Thank you, Matt. And now to the tropics, where scientists have been trying to understand how rainforests influence the chemistry of the atmosphere. It's an ambitious project called OP3. Meera Senthilingam spoke with Nick Hewitt to find out what they've discovered so far.
So OP3 is a very large consortium project. It's called Oxidant and Particle Photochemical Processes Above a Southeast Asian Tropical Rainforest, which is a bit of a mouthful, so we abbreviated that to OP3. The aim of the project is to try and understand how tropical forests and the atmosphere interact together. So tropical forests emit certain compounds into the atmosphere. They take up compounds, also chemicals from the atmosphere. And in doing so, they mediate in the chemistry of the lower atmosphere. So we're trying to understand how tropical atmosphere and the biosphere interact together.
And how did you go about looking into this?
Well, the project is a mixture of field work and modelling activities. So the field work, which took place in Malaysia last year, was based at two ground locations and also using an aircraft, research aircraft.
What did you actually measure?
We threw everything at this. So we measured practically every constituent of the atmosphere conceivable. We measured volatile organic compounds, of which there are hundreds in the atmosphere.
And what are they?
Well, these are compounds, basically hydrocarbons or partially oxidized hydrocarbons, which are produced by plants, by trees, and emitted into the atmosphere. So these are the compounds that you can smell if you walk through a pine forest, for example, or if you smell flowers. You're smelling these reactive volatile organic compounds. The most important of them is isoprene, which is a C5 molecule. It contains a carbon-to-carbon double bond. It's highly reactive in the atmosphere, and it takes part in reactions which lead to the formation of ozone. Ozone in the lower atmosphere is a very important air pollutant. This is different to ozone in the stratosphere, where man's activities are removing the protective layer of ozone in the stratosphere, which protects us from solar radiation. In the lower atmosphere, ozone is harmful to human health, it reduces crop yields, and it's a very important, very significant air pollutant. So we really need to understand how the atmosphere works, chemically works, in the remote areas of the world, especially in the tropics, because they contain most of the biosphere. And so we need to understand how the tropical atmosphere operates. Then we can begin to understand how air pollution and all the associated effects of man's activities are moderating that.
So what have you found so far with your analysis?
The site that we investigated in Malaysia, in Borneo, it's called Bukit Atur. It's in an undisturbed area of rainforest. And we confirmed that it's very clean. The atmosphere there is very clean. The oxides of nitrogen levels are very low. Particle levels are low. Ozone concentrations are low. So it's a very clean, remote site. However, not too far away from this remote site, where the forest has been replaced by plantations, particularly oil palm plantations, man's activities there are influencing the composition of the atmosphere.
And how are they influencing the composition? What did you find in the plantation areas then?
Well, in the plantation areas, it's basically an agro-industrialised landscape. So you're not only replacing natural trees or the natural rainforest with oil palm or palm oil trees, but also all the associated agricultural industrial activity in terms of trucks and people living there, burning fossil fuels for cooking, the processing plants where they process the palm oil. And so this is introducing oxides of nitrogen into the atmosphere. Also, very importantly, is that these oil palm trees themselves emit huge quantities of reactive organic compounds, volatile organic compounds, into the atmosphere, much more so than the rainforest, which they're replacing.
So what does this all mean then? Should we not be making so many plantation areas, or should we be protecting our forests because they're actually taking away these compounds from our atmosphere as a whole?
Well, I don't think it means we should not plant plantations. It doesn't mean we shouldn't develop, for example, biofuels, using oil palm as a biofuel. There's an important economic and environmental benefit to be done with in that direction if we do it properly. What it does mean is we have to be careful about how that's managed, and in particular how nitrogen is managed. Our results show it's very important to minimise the emissions of oxides of nitrogen into the atmosphere in the tropical regions. Clearly, it's very important to maintain the remaining areas of undisturbed tropical rainforest because they provide ecosystem services. They also act as the lungs of the atmosphere.
And so where are you going next with this project? What are you continuing to look into to understand this further?
Now we're analysing all those data. We're running and developing models of the chemistry of the atmosphere. So we have another year or two of the project to run. And depending how our results pan out, then we'll look to see in which direction the follow-up project should go.
So we cut down the tropics at our peril. That was Lancaster University's Nick Hewitt talking to Meera Senthilingam about the OP3 project, which is trying to understand the influence that rainforests have on the atmosphere. One thing that certainly has a major impact on the atmosphere is the ocean, mainly because it's a huge carbon sink. Marine plants utilise carbon dioxide, release oxygen, and then lock away carbon as biomass on the seabed. In fact, some people have suggested that we could combat climate change by fertilising the ocean with iron to encourage the marine plants to grow. But whether this works or not, and what the longer-term impacts could be, aren't known. But now scientists have used a natural example of this happening to find out a bit more. James, tell us about this.
Well, yeah, that's right, Chris. The idea behind this whole area of carbon capture is that if you can get more plankton to grow in the ocean, when they die, they sink to the bottom of the ocean and take some of the carbon down there with them, and it will stay down there for a few hundred years. And so the idea is it's a way of reducing carbon dioxide levels from the atmosphere. The whole plan of getting more plankton to grow is to fertilise them, and iron is one of the nutrients that they need and which the ocean can be lacking in. So if you add more iron into the ocean, then you can increase the growth of these things. What this team have done is looked at natural iron fertilisation off of an island called Crozet's Island, which is a volcanic island, and the rainfall naturally washes iron into the ocean. So they've looked at how those levels affect plankton growth.
And what are they finding?
What they found is that the iron does indeed increase the growth of these plankton. They found that 2 to 3 times more carbon was taken to the bottom of the ocean when this iron level was taken into account. What they actually did to work this out is to use ratios of a couple of radioactive isotopes. They used thorium-232 and uranium-238. The sort of the natural ratio of these two is known, but thorium tends to stick to particles, and so it gets drawn down to the bottom of the ocean, whereas the uranium doesn't. So that affects the ratio of the two, and so you can use that to tell how much stuff is being drawn down to the bottom of the ocean.
A lot of people are saying this is a very good idea. We chuck some iron on the ocean because the ocean's such a powerful carbon sink anyway, it will pull all of the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and lock it away. Others are saying there could be quite a serious ecological impact of doing that. So what does this study add to that argument?
Well, I should add that the authors of this study, which are Raymond Pollard and Richard Saunders at the National Ocean Centre in Southampton, they are very much against artificial iron fertilisation because they argue that sort of the wider implications of, in terms of the ecosystem are really unknown, and that there are better known ways to cut carbon dioxide levels.
Such as?
They argue that using energy more efficiently or even carbon capture into geological deposits would be a less risky way of reducing carbon levels from the atmosphere.
Thank you, James. So certainly food for thought, even if this is food for plankton. Now, Nina, sticking with the sea, this is very interesting because scientists have managed to unlock from rock the secrets of life, effectively. The oldest life ever discovered on Earth has emerged from some rocks in Oman. Tell us about this.
So some scientists that went looking for oil have found something far more interesting. So they've found the first chemical proof of animal life in the form of marine sponges. They found 30 carbon biomarkers that prove that life existed on Earth more than 635 million years ago. And this is 40 to 50 million years older than previous researchers found.
What were the chemicals that they were spotting and how did they find them?
24 isopropyl cholestane is the 30 carbon biomarker they were looking at. So initially they took cores in this salt basin and they dated the layers within the cores using uranium lead isotope dating. And then within each layer, they used gas chromatography mass spectrometry to look at all of the hydrocarbons. So they were looking at a massive range of hydrocarbons for the oil companies. But the one which is of interest here, they found a number of layers, including the bottom layer, which proved that these sponges existed in that time frame.
How did they know there were sponges there? What's the evidence that this is down to sponges, not just some natural process making this 30-carbon chain they've detected?
OK, previous research had shown that this molecule, the 30-carbon molecule, only comes from the breakdown of the cell walls of the sponges. So they were taking it from previous research.
So in other words, because sponges are the only things that make this chemical, we can be reasonably sure that there must have been some kind of sponge around then, historically, that left this chemical vestige in the rock.
Exactly.
So what are the implications of this discovery? What does this mean for evolution and our understanding of where life came from on Earth?
Well, this had been predicted previously, so a group at Dartmouth College had predicted that sponge life started on Earth 635 to 650 million years ago. But these are the first guys to actually prove that they were correct, so it doesn't really change our understanding of how life started on Earth.
What about what was going on Earth at around the same time when they have got these deposits? So if you look at that timeline and then look elsewhere on Earth, were there any dramatic events that could have precipitated this sudden explosion in life around that time?
So it was the melting of a glacial ice age, so the temperature of the sea were changing and the number of algae that were around were changing, so that could possibly have triggered the start of the sponge life.
An amazing story that began with drilling for oil and turned up signs of the earliest animal life on Earth. Thank you, Nina. Well, that's almost it for this month, but James, there's now just time to catch up with the answer to the chemical conundrum.
Well, the question that we had last month was, what is the main jasmine-derived fragrance, which is in almost all of the best-selling fine fragrances? And the answer to that question was methyl dihydrojasminate, also known as Hedione, the trade name. The winner for this month is Yadhunath Kunmani, and this month's question is...
This month we decided to go with a topical theme, so it's a little bit to do with St Patrick's Day, which is coming up next month, and we wanted to know, what is the substance used to remove sediment from Guinness?
And we will pick a winner out of the hat, and the winner will get one of the famous Chemistry World goodie bags. Send your answers to chemistryworld@rse.org, and don't forget to include your address so we can post you the goodie bag.
So if you're a Guinness fan and you think you know the answer, then do drop us a line to chemistryworld@rse.org, and you can also use that same address if you'd like to send us your thoughts or feedback about this or one of our previous Chemistry World podcasts. Don't forget, there's also our weekly podcast called Chemistry in Its Element, where we take a look at the sinister side of the periodic table. You can tune into Chemistry in Its Element on iTunes or via our website at chemistryworld.org/elements. Chemistry World this month was brought to you by James Mitchell Crowe, Nina Notman, Phil Broadwith and Matt Wilkinson. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. Until next time, goodbye.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.